Do you know anything about racehorses, Bill?
Not enough to win at the track, unfortunately.
Well, sometimes you have a yearling with natural speed, but he's wild, ill-tempered. The trainer has a choice. Geld him, he becomes more tractable. But it can take away his spark, the thing that makes him exceptional. So the trainer might put blinders on him. Now, when the horse races, he feels like he's alone. He does what he does best, but on the track. You understand what I'm saying?
You don't want to castrate Holden.
I need you to be Agent Ford's blinders.
I'm assuming you want to keep doing this, Holden, that it's not too stressful for you?
Yes.
Then here's what's going to happen. You're going to take the weekend, get your shit together, and on Monday morning, you're going to present yourself as able, responsible, and fun. Professional. And no one need ever know about this episode. But from now on, it's my rules. If I tell you to shut your mouth, you shut your mouth.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Riches, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds.
And we're going to discuss now, which is season two of Mindhunter, the long-awaited Mindhunter.
Yes.
So let's dive back in.
But here's a question for you guys. So Holden calls Bill from his hospital room, and Bill visits him, and he's clearly still traumatized. And Holden tells him, finally, that he had a panic attack. Now, a panic attack is a little bit in the mental health realm. And I'm wondering, you know, Bill kind of keeps it a secret from the new assistant chief that he's in the hospital. So what is the FBI's sort of, can you talk about this, or law enforcement stance on mental health? I mean, he'd probably almost be better off having a heart attack than having something that
Absolutely. There's no question about it, because the FBI would look at anything like that, any mental health issue, as a threat to security and his security clearance, and he could lose that security clearance and be fired. If an FBI agent can't maintain a top secret security clearance, and that could be from any number of ways, marrying the wrong person, getting involved in drugs, or having mental health issues, that could undermine their security clearance. And so that's why Bill keeps it secret. And it's a major risk, because if Bill doesn't say, and he knows, and then Ford ends up deconstructing, that could blow back on Bill too. And that's always the thing, you know, do you first look at the loyalty to your friends and colleagues, or the loyalty to the Bureau? And that's something that the Bureau wants you to only worry about the Bureau and not about anything else.
Yeah, I mean, all those things are a judgment call. And I think before we get to that stage, we hear Bill being introed to Gunn, and Gunn's already head in the case, isn't he? He's got the earphones on, he's listening to their interview. I mean, again, we now get a sense that this is a very senior person in the FBI who wants to get his sleeves rolled up and wants to get in the material. But he's talking about the Devier case and that there's 5 minutes missing in the interview, and he wants to know who's responsible. So the very first meeting, he puts Bill on the spot, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
And that does happen a lot, first meetings where someone wants to get to know what kind of character you are, you know, that they may give you a pretty tough question. But he does ask who's responsible, and Bill actually does say Agent Ford. And then what follows is this kind of conversation about that vulnerability in another sense, that he's a loose cannon, his instinct is his greatest asset, but it also means that he's impulsive and he can be quite reckless. And so that, again, is a balancing act of, is he an asset to us, or is he someone that we need to curtail?
Right. And again, shades of John Douglas. John Douglas was a risk taker. John Douglas, as many people who break new ground in any field, they have to take risks. They have to be the kind of people that don't necessarily want to play within the four walls of the box. And so they think differently, they act differently. John certainly did that. He drove forward a unit that would have just withered away and died without him. And so it's cool that they're portraying it in this way. I remember early profiles, some of the profiles John did. He took these ridiculous, what we thought were ridiculous risks. He says, this guy will be driving around in a beat up old green van. Like, why did he pick green van? Or this guy will be wearing a three-piece suit and all the buttons will be buttoned. And damn it, he was right. He said Wayne Williams would be driving a white vehicle. And damn it, he was. You know, so it's this, there's something about him that his instincts are spot on. And he really made an amazing career that way. It's not infallible, but there are times where he really blew us away with the complexity and the nuance of the profiles that he created.
These two scenes where you first of all see Bill defending him, and I think that's an important point, that although he says his instincts are problematic and that interrogations are a partnership and sometimes he goes off on his own, but he also says he gets people to talk in no other way that anybody else does. And that is a real skill, mm-hmm. The early onset of this process. And this is where you get the clash between the academic who wants the very structured, rigorous questionnaire and every question followed through. And in reality, you can't sit there with a questionnaire. You have to have fluidity and you have to go where you believe the interview needs to go to get the right answers. And so we see that being played out later on. And I kind of like that they've put that in there of bringing in an academic who challenges the way that they do things. And that was Anne Burgess's character, wasn't it, Jim, of being an expert in certainly rape and trauma and abuse and the psychology side. She was brought in, having given a talk at the FBI at Quantico about the psychological principles. And then she sort of challenged those that she was talking to back and said, you have all got a great opportunity here. Why not interview and right. actually ask questions of them?
Right.
Why don't we do this? And that's really how it all came to pass. And that's why I think the third musketeer, Anne Burgess, Dr. Wendy Carr, I would really like to see her far more in all of this as well, because she did play a key and unique role in the process.
Yeah, I agree. And the real Anne Burgess is much more engaging. I think in general, the way they're playing Dr. Carr's character is a little bit aloof. She has kind of become more one of the guys, right, in this second season. But Anne has done tremendously amazing things for the field of behavioral analysis. And we're really happy to have her. I don't see Anne in the character as much as I see the character kind of having her own identity on this show.
Right. This is where I would have loved to have had seen much more of a female consultant or female lens of perspective here, because her POV, like the female POV in an all male dominated environment, you know, if you having to become one of the guys to fit in, where actually right. the uniqueness is the thing that should stand out. And that's the strength.
Right.
But I remember reading a lot of Anne's books when I was at New Scotland Yard and running the sexual offences section there. And it was really instrumental, her work, to me. And psychology is really the key aspect. It underpins everything. This is all about human behaviour. But I would love to, see the POV of just her character. That's a whole show on its own, right? Of going into a male-dominated environment and just a clash of culture. Academic right. meets practical, you know, out in the field. And we see some of that going on. So she's the inspiration. And she's actually called in to meet Gunn as well, isn't she? And he sort of grills her as to what's going on. He wants to get her measure and also wants to speak to both of them about whether Ford is an asset or whether he's an hindrance. And then he wants both of them to harness him so that he knows that he is a loose cannon and that's he's the golden boy of the unit, I think you called him, Lisa, at one point. But he also wants to be reassured that they're both sort of harnessing him but allowing him to still maintain the magic of what he brings to the unit.
Right.
Same penitentiary as one of our other subjects who was convicted of 8 murders, William Pierce Jr. So you could get them both at the same time.
He's getting us Manson.
Excuse me?
Ted told me he's getting us Manson.
How'd that happen?
Manson doesn't really fit into the category of psychosexuals that we've interviewed.
You're saying we shouldn't talk to the most infamous murderer of the 20th century?
Manson never killed anyone. Unlike all of these subjects who have multiple times and at least once with a sexual component.
I kind of agree with Dr. Carr. We can't just go after the infamous.
Okay.
There's this conflict. We were talking about Dr. Wendy, and there's this conflict because she very methodically wants to go through their next subject, you know, the subjects for interviews, and, you know, Holden comes back and he's just like, no, I want to have Manson, you know, and this is all due to the meeting that he has with Assistant Director Voldemort, you know, who's just giving him, you know, free rein to just go and have results, make results. So I just wanted to ask you, is this in conflict? Like, on the one hand, is the BSU... Is that right? BSU? Are they trying to be, a database, a clearinghouse of knowledge, or are they supposed to be closing cases? Like, what's the raison d'etre?
Okay. When they started, they literally were an academic unit, and they taught at the FBI Academy and the FBI's National Academy. If people don't know what those mean, the FBI Academy is where they teach new agent trainees, FBI agents in training there, and the National Academy is where they teach sort of high-level detectives and police officers and rising police chiefs. They have basically a master's level course for police officers there. So that's where the behavioral science unit is located, and their mandate was to teach new agent trainees and National Academy police officers. So when the kernel of this unit started to form, it was literally to do research to teach when they went into their classroom. But the process, what actually happened was police officers would present them questions in the course of their work, and they would go off when they went back home to their offices, and they would implement those suggestions. And some of them would call back and say, hey, I looked where you told me to look. Oh my God, I solved this case. And it happened again and again and again. And that's, they started saying, hey, Douglas and Ressler and Roger DePue, you know, they had this idea that, hey, let's make this official. And they got turned down by the Bureau. Well, they didn't listen to it. They kept going and they kept going and they kept getting more and more successes. And finally, the FBI director said, hey, this is good. We should make this real. That's when they actually converted that research group into a unit that would actually solve cases.
But I think this is a key point in this scene with the assistant director and Holden saying, putting him to the challenge, you deliver for me and I will make OPR go away. And that has a consequence in this last scene that we're going to talk about. How do you need to go away? What is the quid pro quo?
There is a quid pro quo, and I think that was actually brilliant. And I'm sure that was the result of John Douglas telling them that in the FBI, someone will always pay. And so there's this great retirement scene. And I have to tell you that a number of retirements that I attended over the course of my career in the FBI looked exactly like that. Boys club, drinking, quiet, just very reserved. Couple of things handed out, a couple of speeches made, and everybody goes home. That's not what my retirement was like. My retirement was insane. But this is definitely what they depicted, was definitely a very Bureau retirement. Nobody would get out of hand. Everybody had to sort of be, you know, in conformity and all that kind of stuff. So that was really good. But what I thought was amazing was the scene where Holden gets up to talk, to say some kind words about his leadership and how he hopes that he goes out and catches some big fish. And the guy walks out on him. Holden could not understand why. So he approaches him and he's very sort of deer in the headlights when the assistant director turns on him and he says, you arrogant little punk, you know, and he lets him have it because, well, he wasn't retiring on his own. He was retiring because he was forced to retire. That was the quid pro quo for making the OPR go away, was putting it on his shoulders and kicking him out of the FBI, the job he loved, the job he did really well, and Holden was to blame. Mm-hmm. And what happens? Throws Holden into an entirely new panic attack.
Right. You vainglorious little shit. I love that. That was a great one.
I just wanted to let you know,
I meant what I said in there.
I'm sure you did, Agent Ford.
Are you okay, sir?
Yeah, just think about tomorrow. First day of retirement.
You're practically sneaking out of your own party. I just feel like...
Oh, I can't wait to hear how you feel. You arrogant, self-serving twerp. I put in 27 years, went from brick agent to corner office, and I'm leaving everything I worked for with the giant stain of you all over it.
Sir...
Do you honestly believe I'm retiring? You vain, glorious little shit. I'm being forced out because somebody has to take the fall for your insubordination, reckless lack of judgment, and titanic vanity.
I took complete responsibility
for...
You
really are incredible. Is all of that fresh-scrubbed earnestness just an act, or are you truly oblivious to the wreckage you leave in your wake?
Great line. It was a great scene, Jim, but as a behavioral profiler, he didn't read the room very well, did he?
No.
I mean, exactly. Like, read the room, take the temperature. I'm just saying, you know, he would have noticed that suddenly the oxygen left the room very quickly.
Yeah.
That all those things you have to take a read of. But when they were in the boardroom before that, I mean, I remember those, the boardroom letters and like the interior, the first kind of do.
They got it perfect.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
It really was. And I love the line. I mean, Bill Tench has some bloody brilliant lines in Mindhunter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of them, they were talking about the BSU and it's being the greatest legacy of Robert Shepard, et cetera. And they're really bigging it up. And he said, that's a lot of icing, very little cake. He has these moments that are just so brilliant with his lines. So, yeah, I mean, I agree. I think the end of it, I mean, there was a real nod to misogyny there, even just with the language, the panic attack that he starts to have, and Shepard turning around saying, you really are a pussy, and just completely, stripping him down. And then obviously Holden goes off and he's struggling to breathe and takes the pills. And then we get the overload coming on and blasting out, and the music again just takes it away. So I think there are some great nods, you know, rooms full of men, which I've been in many, many times. And that's why I really feel like part of it is about the culture, the zeitgeist of where it's come from. But having a female lens, well, I thought that Debbie, do you remember Holden's girlfriend in season one? I thought she might return to give another female kind of perspective, but that's a great shame. She was a brilliant character. I wish she was on the scene.
They didn't even address it. It's just, she's gone. But I wanted to ask you though, Laura, I mean, it's another misogynistic thing when the assistant director calls Ford a pussy. I mean, again, it's like, you're a girl, a piece of girl's anatomy. You know, that's his insult to him, right? And mm-hmm. I will say that throughout this episode and throughout the season, there's a number of things that are homophobic and misogynistic. And, you know, and I think they're doing that deliberately to sort of capture the time. Because mm-hmm. back in the day, especially in law enforcement, it was completely acceptable to have all these biases. Everybody has to be, you know, rah-rah, all-American, straight and, you know, perfect and manly if they're going to be in law enforcement. And God help you if you're not. So I think that's something that they're bringing out, and it's something that's unfortunately real. And much of that persists today, doesn't it?
Very much so. And that's where I've certainly come from, the culture where I've come from. And it's just been part and parcel. It's just been all around you. Some things you don't realize. I think early on in my career, I didn't realize that it was about my sex, my gender. I thought it was very personal to me. And as I got older, I realized that it wasn't about that. But it takes some time to figure those things out. And so, yes, they are giving a nod to it. I think even when Bill Tench goes to pick Holden up from the facility, he's pretty brutal with him. You know, can you dress yourself and pull yourself together? And these are my rules, you know. And so he doesn't give him really any latitude around the fact he's had this experience.
But Bill, even to his son, he says, when he come out of church in the very first scene, and he says, go play with these guys. And his wife said, oh, he's going to play football. And he said, more like smear the queer. And maybe that's what they used to call, a game where they ran around and jumped on whoever had the ball. I don't know. But, you know, clearly that kind of stuff, has no place in society today, but it certainly did back then.
But he's aware of it too, because Laura, what does Bill say to Dr. Wendy, you know, in at the party? He's like, you know, be careful when you see these guys loosening their tie. Get the hell out of there, you know?
Yep, reading the sign. And we see that later on come out as well at the, I think it's episode 4 where they go to a party. And so, you know, we're continually getting those nods, but that is the reality. And I'm glad that they're not diverting or shying away from those things, but we do have to talk about the misogyny aspect,
right?
Cultures and that are still operating and still a major challenge.
Well,
yes, indeed.
That brings us to the end of episode 1 of season 2 of Mindhunter, which is inspired by the life and professional career of my mentor and one of our colleagues and friends who really is legendary in the field of profiling, John Douglas. And hats off to him and his work and his writing with Mark Olshaker. And I can't wait to get into next week to start episode 2.
Absolutely. And my plug, John Douglas and Mark Olshaker, if you're listening to this, please bring in a female consultant. I might be available. I mean, you know, if you did want to talk about it, I would probably be free. You know, I could find some time. That's all I'm saying.
There you go. All right. Well, until next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.